States against Moon.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Ralph Washington. I represent the appellant, Anthony Alexander, on this appeal. This case arose out of the Northern District of Indiana, Hammond Division, in which a verdict was returned on February 8th of 05 on a superseding indictment.
Could you keep your voice up, please?
On a superseding indictment where Mr.
No, don't move the microphone. Do not touch the microphone.
I'm sorry. The case arose on a superseding indictment from Mr. Appellant Anthony Alexander, in which he was charged in 8 counts. A conspiracy count, a cocaine base count, and 2 counts for use of a facility telephone in the commission of a conspiracy. We allege that in count 3 of the indictment that the evidence is insufficient as to the cocaine charge for crack. The evidence there was that there was a DEA chemist, James DeFrancisco, who testified that he had not tested the drugs, the cocaine base allegedly crack in count 3, that a different DEA chemist had tested the drugs, and Mr. Francisco, the testifying chemist.
Was this issue preserved at trial?
Yes, it was not preserved at trial.
The next question is, was it waived at trial? The district judge asked whether there were any objections. An objection was made based on chain of custody. The judge then says, are there any other problems here? And trial counsel said, no. Is that not a waiver?
It's a waiver, but we claim that the judge discretion in order to...
Well, counsel, I'm sure you know that the Supreme Court held in Olano that if an issue is waived, there is no review even for plain error.
We're alleging that the evidence was insufficient as to the cocaine/cocaine base. Therefore, the testimony of the testifying DEA chemist was entirely hearsay. And therefore, my client was not.
No, I don't get it. The evidence was admitted.
Correct.
And therefore counts for purposes of sufficiency. Whether the evidence was admitted over a hearsay objection is a separate question. That's the one I'm now asking, whether the argument you are currently making wasn't affirmatively waived in the district court when trial counsel represented that there were no objections other than chain of custody.
I'm alleging that the evidence was that the testimony by the DEA chemist was hearsay evidence, and therefore my client's constitutional right in the Sixth Amendment was not waived.
You're not addressing the waiver issue, Mr. Washington. We can't reach the question whether there was a hearsay problem or the Sixth Amendment problem if there was a waiver. That's what I wish you would address. Is that kind of representation to the district court a waiver, or is it just a forfeiture?
Well, it would be a forfeiture, but I don't accept the proposition that it's not before the court. But with regards to that sentence imposed by the court, we allege that that sentence was an enhanced sentence for cocaine/crack. And the sentence should have been within the guidelines of level 16, about 46 to 57 months, as opposed to a life sentence that was imposed by the court. The evidence in the court below was primarily from the DEA chemist DeFrancisco and from a confidential informant who alleged that the appellant provided him cocaine/crack. Is our position there's nothing in the record that would indicate that this confidential informant had any prior street dealings with regards to cocaine/crack, as from the record? He did testify what transpired during a supposed transaction between the appellant and the confidential informant, but there was nothing in the record to suggest that this person had any street experience with regards to crack. My client's primarily going on the case of United States v. Edwards, in which that court case ruled that all cocaine base is not necessarily crack. And we'll reserve the rest of our time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Washington.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Connor, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Moon today. And briefly to address the issue the court just raised with Mr. Washington regarding a waiver issue, I would point out to the court that in this case, the government has not alleged that, in fact, that issue was waived, but has, in fact, stated in its brief that this issue is to be determined under a plain error standard, Your Honor. Though they do point out that no specific objection was raised, they cite in their brief at page 38 that they agree, in fact, that it is a plain error standard.
So your view is they've waived the waiver problem.
That's correct, Your Honor. I didn't bring a case with me to talk about that because I didn't anticipate the issue based on the government's brief. However, Your Honor, there is Seventh Circuit law that indicates quite specifically when the government does not allege waiver in its reply brief, just as if that issue is lost. And, Your Honor, the government has, in fact, agreed in this case that plain error standard does, in fact, apply. Your Honor, I think it's important to point out, though Mr. Moon is not concerned about the issue of a determination of crack because the counts he was convicted of do not involve a crack analysis, the same issue does apply in terms of the sufficiency of evidence argument. Excuse me, the hearsay argument that the court clarified in terms of the very important element of what was the nature of the substance seized from Mr.
I don't understand that. And the evidence is what the evidence is. Whether it was properly admitted is a different question. But we've held in the past that for purposes of establishing the sufficiency of the evidence, we look at everything that was in fact admitted.
I'm going to step back, Your Honor, because I allowed myself to step in Mr. Washington's shoes for a second. I raised this issue as an error, an evidentiary error on the court's part in terms of allowing the expert to testify from pure hearsay, Your Honor. And therefore, it is an evidentiary error. However, Your Honor, it is far from harmless because it goes to the very core of
harmless,
the case.
Even if we put waiver to one side, it's not the harmless error standard. It's the plain error standard. And assuming that we evaluate it on the plain error standard, you have to persuade us not only to adopt the position taken by the dissent in the recent Fourth Circuit's case of U.S. against Washington, which parties might have filed supplemental memos on, but you know, this is an issue that split the Fourth Circuit. First, you want us to adopt the dissent's position, and then you want us to overlook the fact that the chemist who was on the stand said that he had evaluated the results independently and agreed with his colleague's conclusion, which makes it rather hard to see plain error.
Your Honor, the record, and I believe it once again, the government brief actually in laying out its facts points out that in this case, what the expert did was examine the test results and reports of another expert. There is no independent analysis of any type done in this case. At best, what
now,
the...
What I maybe I'm misunderstanding, but when you say no independent analysis, you mean chemist number one ran the spectrometer and said, here are the readings I get, and I interpret this as cocaine. Chemist number two then on the stand says, chemist number one ran the gas chromatograph or whatever the particular instrument was. Here are the readings he got. He interpreted that as cocaine, and so do I, because that's what those readings from a gas chromatograph mean. Now, is that a... Do not touch the microphone. Is that a fair understanding of what happened?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor, because what this second expert did was read what the first expert claimed to have done, read the results that were read, that were apparently reached by that expert, and then basically vouched for his view that the first expert was a credible expert. There was no independent analysis of any type in this case. And, Your Honor, I believe if you were to remove what would expert Olson's conclusions, all from his report, there's no issue that this came from a report, there would be nothing left to determine weight and to determine the actual nature of the substance tested. There would be nothing left. And, Your Honor, under Lawson, which is cited, I believe, in both Mr. Washington and my brief.
Now, but I just want to make sure that I understand what you're saying, because what you're saying differs from the way I read this testimony. It's perfectly normal in litigation for a testimonial expert to say, someone else ran test X, actually collected the data, and that data can be data produced by a machine or data produced by an independent test or data collected by somebody who conducted last year's census. And then the testimonial expert says, and here's what those data mean. And as I understand your argument, you're saying that all of those uses of expert testimony are unconstitutional.
Your Honor, I don't believe the record's clear that, first of all, it happened the way the court is explaining. In this case, the expert was provided the reports and work of expert Olson, and then expert DeFrancesca testified that he believed, based on his contact with expert Olson, that his conclusions were verifiable, that he had met with Mr. Olson on many occasions, they were in a relationship in the lab. However, Your Honor, in looking to the case of Lawson, the Seventh Circuit has previously followed, in essence, the argument that I'm purporting to the court. And that is, of course, under Rule 702 and other provisions regarding expert testimony, we anticipate that an expert is going to, in fact, rely on other experts' conclusions. However, it is a different matter when a purported expert walks into court and simply testifies exclusively to the testing and findings of another expert. Your Honor, I believe that I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Connor. Mr. Bella.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Daniel Bella, arguing the case for the government. There are a multitude of issues raised in the two briefs filed by the defendants. Only a few, I think, are being discussed here today. One that has not been discussed is sufficiency of the evidence of the conspiracy. And I think the evidence was more than sufficient to sustain the jury's verdict here. There was an agreement between Moon and Alexander that Moon to provide Alexander with 4 to 5 to 6 meals, which the expert witness, Eric Lee, testified meant an agreement to meet in the future for the provision of multiple kilos of cocaine. And in the same conversation, there was an agreement that even after the cocaine was delivered, the following week, Moon would come back through town and collect payment. So there is an agreement in advance for a fronting of drugs at some point in the future and a payment thereafter. The conversations between Moon and Alexander and the course of conduct between them also indicate that this
only happened once. Is that correct? This, the fronting? procedure? Have evidence of?
Then that's where I was headed, Your Honor. The course of conduct and conversations between Moon and Alexander indicate that they had an ongoing relationship. Now, the wiretap was only up during a two-month period, and so it captured these conversations. But the course of conduct between them indicates that this relationship extended far before these dates. And the way the conspiracy is charged, it's charged that this occurred from at least 8/11/04 through 8/20/04, the precise dates unknown to the jury. And the reason I say that this relationship had to have extended beyond those dates is that there are several things that indicate that. When they converse, Alexander tells Moon those 90 days are almost up, indicating that he had had a previous supply of cocaine from Moon, and that was almost gone. It was time for a resupply. There was a conversation on July 24 of 04 where Moon and Alexander planned to meet the next day, but additional conversations were not intercepted after that to show the detail, and the wiretap had just gone up, so there weren't conversations before that to show what was going on there. But that's an indication that there was, in fact, a previous meeting between Moon and Alexander for supply of cocaine. Also, in these conversations that were intercepted, they never even talk about what address for Moon to go to. He knows where to go to. And he knows about what quantities Alexander wants, 4 to 5 to 6 meals, 4 to 6 kilos. The DEA deliberately increased the amount of drugs they were purchasing from Alexander to get to his source of supply. And so on the sale on 8/11/04, 0.5 kilo of cocaine, that was the biggest amount they had purchased from Alexander at one time. And they did that deliberately, hoping that it would force him to call a source of supply. And the timing of the events on that day is interesting because there is a phone call made between the CI and Alexander agreeing to meet for the half-kilo purchase. And, of course, the DEA, since that's their CI, they're recording the conversation. They know the exact time of that conversation. Then they have surveillance at 4275 Martin Luther King Drive in Gary, where Alexander goes to get his drugs before he goes to these deals. He did that on multiple occasions. And they see him arrive to pick up the half-kilo of cocaine, probably, to bring to that deal. And so they have the exact time of that. And they also see him through surveillance arrive to meet the CI to sell the cocaine to the CI. So they have the exact time of that, and they intercept in between those times. After the agreement is made to purchase the half kilo of cocaine and before the time that the CI and Alexander actually meet for that purchase, between those two times, they intercept a telephone call where Alexander is calling Moon. Alexander already knows he's made an agreement to sell that quantity of cocaine. He needs more. And the first person he calls is Moon, and he says that 90 days is almost up, meaning I need a resupply. And so I would suggest to the court that a drug dealer does not, on the spur of the moment, decide who to call for that kind of transaction, for that kind of supply of quantity. Alexander knew who he was going to call because that was his regular supplier. And there was another conversation where Alexander calls Moon and says, I'm just calling to check up on you, see how you're doing. And he's making sure that his source of supply is still viable. So this is I think there's evidence in the record of an ongoing relationship between Moon and Alexander. And the court has previously said that where there's a fronting of drugs to be paid for later, that's evidence of a conspiracy. How much more powerful evidence of a conspiracy is it where there's an agreement in advance to front drugs in the future and then to pay for the drugs after that? And that's what happened here. With regards to the expert testimony, Rule 703 of the Federal Rules of Evidence expressly permits an expert to testify based upon the test results of other experts, if that's the kind of evidence that an expert routinely relies upon. And that's what happened here. And I would suggest that I would agree with the court in its characterization of DeFrancisco's testimony. That is, that his testimony was that Olson conducted these tests, these were the test results. I've examined his test results. These are the same tests I would have conducted, and based on these test results, I conclude that this is crack cocaine, that this is marijuana, that this is powder cocaine, etc. And to the extent that he says anything about Olson's conclusions...
Now, as you know, at least one judge, Judge Michael of the Fourth Circuit, has concluded that Rule 703 is unconstitutional. Is there any other ongoing litigation about this subject?
There have been cases with regard to the Crawford issue, Your Honor.
That's why Judge Michael thinks Rule 703 is unconstitutional.
There have been other cases. Well, the government cites Henry, but there are other cases that have, since the government's brief was filed, also have cited Henry. And I'm not aware of any other case saying that. And the import of the Henry case is that the Crawford doesn't apply to testimony given pursuant to Rule 703. The chemist who rendered these conclusions, DeFrancisco, testified in court and was available for cross-examination and was cross-examined. And it's the conclusions of DeFrancisco, based upon the test results of Olson, but not the conclusions of Olson. It's the independent conclusions or opinions of DeFrancisco that were before the jury. And DeFrancisco testified and was subject to cross-examination. In Davis versus Washington, the Supreme Court tried to explain the notion of testimonial hearsay, because that's what Crawford applies to. It doesn't apply to all hearsay. It applies to what they call testimonial hearsay. And in that case, the Supreme Court was trying to draw a line between answers given to interrogation where the primary purpose of the interrogation was to preserve testimony for later use in a criminal prosecution, and answers given to interrogation where there's an ongoing emergency. If the Supreme Court is trying to draw that kind of fine line between what is and what is not testimonial hearsay, I would suggest to the court that the Supreme Court certainly would not extend Crawford to Rule 703 and the longstanding notion that an expert can testify based upon test results of others. And I would even say that if you took the reports of Olson, extracting his conclusions, his opinions as to the identity of the drugs, but took his reports that I conducted this test and this was the result, I made this visual observation, this was the result, that would even be admissible as a business record, exception of the hearsay rule. It's objective analysis, objective observations that he was required to make and to record, and I think it's that a subsequent expert, like DeFrancisco, was permitted to rely upon those, informing his own independent conclusion as to the identity of these substances. Also, we have testimony in the record that was non-expert testimony as to the crack cocaine, starting first with some of the observations of the expert, DeFrancisco. He said it was chunky, it's wet, it's consistent with crack cocaine. Crack cocaine is a form of cocaine base that's chunky and wet, and that's what this was. He actually physically examined the cocaine. He actually physically examined the marijuana. So even though DeFrancisco didn't conduct all the objective tests that Olson did, he actually physically examined these substances. In addition, Alexander offered to sell Moore, another CI, cocaine that was hard, and Moore testified that means crack cocaine. And Moore and Alexander discussed crack cocaine versus powder cocaine, and they discussed the varying costs and profit margins of crack versus powder. And Alexander told Moore that he had crack cocaine that was all bagged up. And then on page 50 of the government's brief, it sets forth some of the testimony of Moore. Moore said that Alexander gave him a bag of crack cocaine, and Moore described it as containing pieces of crack cocaine. So Moore is also testifying as to what he observed of the substance. And this court has said before that the real experts on what is crack cocaine are the drug dealers themselves. And Moore's testimony, along with all the other evidence, clearly indicates that this is crack cocaine. And I would also indicate that there is nothing in the record to make us doubt in any way the opinions of DeFrancisco or the testimony that this was crack cocaine. There was nothing to call that into doubt. So I would suggest that on a plain error standard, the substantial rights of the defendants were not violated here. Unless the court has any other questions, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Washington?
We contend that the DeFrancisco testimony was nothing more than just a summary of Olson's testimony being produced as original evidence. All DeFrancisco did was parrot what Olson said. And therefore, it was clearly hearsay. The opinion may be one that one may be want to introduce based on some report, but the report cannot be cross-examined. Mr. Olson was not there. His results were there. Mr. DeFrancisco testified only as to Olson's results. Throughout the record, if you look closely at DeFrancisco's testimony, he clearly says, I concur with what Mr. Olson says. I concur with what Mr. Olson said. He did not in himself conduct any scientific tests. In fact, he said he could not conclude scientifically that the evidence in count three was a crack as known by a street name, but cocaine base. With regards to Moore and Moore, as I indicated, Mr. Moore referred to the evidence in count four, the cocaine crack.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Washington.
Or as cocaine.
Thank you, Mr. Washington.
Thank you.
Ms. Connor, anything further?
Though I did not reach the issues, I do think it's important to emphasize that both that the issues related to the conspiracy, which we have briefed, are extremely important. I don't agree with Mr. Bella's interpretation of the record in this case. Setting aside the telephone conversations intercepted between August 11th and August 17th, what we have is surveillance being conducted on Mr. Alexander, Mr. Moon pulling up at the house, walking into the house with a cooler, walking out of the house with a cooler, driving off. He is then stopped, and drugs and money are found in his car. However, later, there is another meeting, and there is a stop following that meeting, and $20,000 is found in the back seat of Mr. Alexander's car. So clearly, that may be some indication by inference that a drug deal had at some point occurred. We have no drugs that were exchanged or witnessing of a drug exchange. And, excuse me, without the interpretation of the actual conversations, which are very limited, there can be no conspiracy. Therefore, not only was it improper to admit the statements under a co-conspirator statement, but with or without those statements, all the government has is a suggestion that the second meeting may have been to settle a bill. That is it. Under this circuit's case law, that is not sufficient evidence of a conspiracy. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.